start. Thank you very much.
Hello, students. We continue our lecture. The first thing I would like to say is that I made a mistake with respect to the paper you have to write. I said, well, that the deadline is about the end of March, but as a matter of fact, it is halfway April. So the 15th, 14th of April. But the sooner I get the paper in my possession, the better it is. Okay, cerebral palsy. One second, please. I can't find it. I'm sorry, cerebral palsy. Here you can read that it is an umbrella term covering a group of non-progressive but often changing motor impairment syndromes secondary to lesions or anomalies of the brain arising in the early stages of development. Those who have followed the course of biopsychology, they have seen this picture already, but there are a few students who have not followed that course, so I have to explain that it is non-progressive. That means that, in a sense, the problem is not getting worse. What is, of course, the case in diseases like Parkinson, for instance. That is a progressive disease. Here you can see a child right from the start after birth could develop cerebral palsy, and that all the problems which are connected with cerebral palsy will show up as a function of development, growing into the deficit. For sure, the impairment is due to lesions in the brain, so injuries of the brain. However, in maybe 20% of the patients, it is hardly impossible to identify which parts of the brains are compromised in this group of children, and therefore the diagnosis is made by means of observations. Is the child able to walk independently or not? Because here you can see that that could be the case. Special shoes, and here you have a wheelchair. So we are talking about these groups of children. Why? Because I want to show you the power of the EEG measure. How can we use the EEG measure, and in particular the event-related potentials, in clinical neuropsychological research? That is, in fact, the reason why I choose for this theme. There are, of course, different types of cerebral palsy, and that's why it's called an umbrella term. It could be that part of the body is concerned. You can see here, we call this hemiplegia, so half of the body is concerned. We have also quadriplegia. It means that the legs and the arms are compromised, and here we have diplegia. I think that most of the jail children, and then they also grow older, of course, they have diplegia, the spastic type. So anyhow, the motor part is concerned. This is a way to measure what children are able to do or not to do, and you see it is all functional. So here, this is a child with special shoes, but he is able to walk independently, and he can even carry things. So then we talk about level one, and this is some sort of a questionnaire, which is normally filled in by the caretakers. This is the level two, that the child needs some support, yeah, to walk the chairs. And here we have the level three, that the child needs some aids or a wheelchair in order to walk. And yeah, here is level four. The difference here is that the child has enough power in his neck to put the neck away from the wheelchair, whereas here he needs also an aid. And here, this is the most severe level, level five. It doesn't mean that those children who are in the most severe level, that they have a low IQ. That is not necessarily the case. I think that about 40% could have an IQ lower than the normal range. And here you have the opposite, that the far the majority of the children have a normal IQ. So the children are, of course, tested during the life many times, maybe. Also, in order to investigate which type of school they could join, and how the child is developing. Anyhow, here we have the brain of a child with CP. This is the normal brain, and this is the brain of a child with CP. And in this case, you see that the ventricles, this is one, that they are different in this group of children. And there is a lot of pressure most of the times on it. And here you see a child tested. The child is looking to the screen. And here is a button the child has to press. And that's the way it goes. You see that the buttons are also different in comparison to buttons which are normally used when we talk about children with ADHD, for instance, or children with autism. The buttons are bigger and they are pushed by the whole hand, as you can see. And what is the child seeing? Now, yeah, all kinds of animals, for instance, and fruit on the screen. And what do you see? This is a dog, and it is then yes or a no. All kinds of questions are made, and the child has to make a decision. What is the normal outcome of this type of reaction time research, because this is a reaction time. Eh? The child has push. It is a yes or a no. In this case, no response. Well, you can see here an outcome of those studies. That children with CP, they are probably slower than the controls and are making more errors. And the idea behind this study and other studies is that those children have a lack of inhibitory control because they are slower and they are making more errors. Why is this type of research done? This reaction time research? Because when you look at here, then here we see all kinds of clinical neuropsychological tests. We have discussed this discrepancy earlier. Clinical diagnostic tests are simply to measure the cognitive motor skills in individual children, to compare them with the norm and to see what their scores are. And people in the clinic have a problem with those tests, and I will explain it to you. Here you can read functional level in children with cerebral palsy. Then it can be the case that the child is able to speak. Then, when it comes to, for instance, measuring the IQ, this test can be used, the WISC or the NAPSI, and these are normal school achievement tests. So these tests are adequate to use in the domain of cerebral palsy when children are able to speak. But there are, of course, also children who are able to speak, but they have problems in visual motor skills. And then all kinds of tests, clinical tests, can't be used in the clinic. For instance, block design. What does it mean, a block design test? Well, a child with cerebral palsy has a lot of wooden blocks in front of him, and he has to make towers with his hands. He has to make all kinds of figures with his hands. So there are, let's say, examples of figures he has to make, and then he is using his hands to form with those blocks, so that there is a fit between what he made and what he and that example. But when your hands are compromised, then you can understand that you are much slower. It is not out of the question that some blocks are even falling on the floor, because the child is handicapped. He has severe limitations. So then you can't use, for instance, the block designs, the coding. There are many tests you can't use. And then other methods are recommended with little time limits. Why is that without time limits? Because the more pressure you give the child, the less good the child will perform. Can you imagine that you have problems with moving your hands? There is time pressure because in front of you, somebody is testing you and he is using a stopwatch. Now, yeah, then you become nervous and you make a mess out of the test. So in this case, other tests are then recommended. There are also children who hardly can speak, And in addition to that, they have problems in the visual motor domain. So this is, of course, quite a big group of children with all kinds of verbal problems. So then you can't use all kinds of language tests to measure the fluency of the speech because of this problem here. And other tests are then recommended. So on the one hand, the neuropsychologists who are working in the clinical field, they do their best to measure cognitive motor abilities in children. That's for sure. But the tests are, let's say, questionable with respect to the use, because these tests are used when children hardly speak. But it is, of course, questionable whether these tests are really measuring the cognitive or motor abilities tested here. And experts, again, I repeat myself, are doing their best to optimize the reliability of those tests, but still, it is questionable. Here you can read it. Recognition of the limitations of traditional neuropsychological assessment instruments and models. So it is well recognized in the clinical field how to measure, how to test children with severe limitations. You can read it here. Long-standing concern that traditional cognitive measures are not accessible to children with significant communicative and motor impairments. Can you imagine that when you are deaf, we could say the same? When you are blind, unfortunately, there are many children who are blind in addition to all kinds of other problems. So how to test them? There are tests available. They are developed by experts, but the tests have their limitations. So before starting now the event-related response studies we have carried out in Finland, I would like to go again to the reason why researchers are using reaction time tests. They are interested in cognitive abilities. Children have to differentiate, and they make their response clear by a particular reaction time. And the idea is that these tests are more precise than the tests we have now discussed, which are used in the clinics. The problem is, I go back again, that there is still motor performance involved. So what the researchers try to do is to measure the quality and the speed of decision making, which takes place here in the brains. But the test used, the outcome, the score of the test is, let's say, confounded by motor behavior. So the question is that findings like these, people have problems with impulse control and people are slower. So the real question is, yeah, because an overt reaction time is used, maybe those reaction time tests are also confounded and don't give a clear picture of the cognitive abilities in children. Because although cognition should be measured, that is the target, what they in reality measure is cognition, cognitive abilities, plus the reaction time. Now, what we try to do is to overcome these studies by using event-related potentials. And this was probably the first type of studies done in the whole world using event-related potentials. So it can be seen as a pioneer study, which means that you must not ask questions about the extrapolation of the findings. That would be not fair. We were simply trying to measure using this tool in a small sample of children with mild spastic CP. We don't start with the most severe cases, of course not. It is, let's say, a trial. Is it possible to measure event-related potentials in these children? These studies were carried out in Finland, in Tampere, and in Jyväskylä. And the person who was carrying out his research wrote a dissertation about this subject. And here you see the group characteristic. You can read the verbal IQ. And you can also read, this was the total IQ. This is the verbal IQ. This is the performance IQ. And we did the utmost in order to create a so homogeneous group as possible, but nevertheless, this subject had a total IQ of 64. So that means this subject was had an IQ below the lower range of normal functioning. But the IQ measure is not the only measure. It's not the only index of mental retardation. And using other tests, it was found out that this case was not mentally retarded. And the same holds for this case. And for this case, 72. So with respect to the IQ, we can say, well, the children were a homogeneous group because we were able to cater 14 cases, and the more heterogeneity you have in your small sample, the more complicated, of course, the results can be interpreted. And here we have that measure we already have discussed earlier. Level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, level 5, you can see that there were a few children with a level 3, but most of them level 1 and level 2, which means that the group was also quite homogeneous with respect to the functionality. And here you can read that many children were either diplegia or hemiplegia. So all in all, if you are reading such studies, you must ask yourself the question, is this a pioneer study? Or is this a study where the researchers are trying to investigate the whole universe of cerebral palsy. These questions are, you can imagine, totally different. This was, and then I repeat myself, nothing more and nothing less than the first trial. The best thing to do is to make the groups as homogeneous as possible. And then you can imagine that the end sentence in the discussion section always is, more studies are needed to replicate the findings, and also more studies are needed to investigate the generability, and severe cases against mild cases. Okay, here the methodology. We have already discussed this last week. This was the most simple way of measuring the event-related potentials. Here you can see the positions of the electrodes, frontal, central, and posterior, backwards. This is the nose. Here are the ears. And this is the daughter of the person who was carrying out the experiment, and she was serving like the first child. So she was invited in the laboratory many times because the candidate had to learn how to put the cap on and all kind and to use it, to use the complicated computers and things like that. This I have explained to you. Here we have the raw EEG. Here we have those electrode positions, and we are searching for an event. And here we have an event, and then we are summing up all the information which was taking place here during the event. And then, for you it must be familiar, we have discussed this last week. This is the moment that the child is hearing or seeing a stimulus, and then it goes like this. This is the N, negativity, because negative is upwards. And this peak stands for encoding, the moment that the brain has encoded the type of stimuli. And here we have that famous P300, which could stand for decision making. P is positive peak, 3 means 300, and then it depends on how complex the task is when this amplitude is maximizing. We all have discussed this. So, by means of this methodology, we can measure some important, not all, but at least some important steps, cognitive steps, which are taking place in the brain. What do I see? You have to encode, and what to decide. And now it comes without using the motor response. Normally the motor response should be take place here, but in children with CP, it could be take place here, outside the possibilities here even. So the question is it so that those cognitive processes are compromised in people with a motor disturbance? We don't have to prove anymore that those children have a motor disturbance. We can see it. The point is, to what extent are the cognitive motor, the cognitive processing, let's say, camouflaged by the motor processes, and that you interpret your data, in fact, in a wrong way. So here we have a very simple model, a very simple cognitive model. It is developed by a person called Sternberg, and he was publishing about his model already in 1966, 67 or something like that. So here we have to encode material. We have to carry out all kinds of memory processes, decision-making. And here, when you have made the decision, you come with the motor preparation. And all these steps are mirrored by the latency and the amplitude of certain components. So once again, N2, encoding, P3, decision-making, and this is a motor index, and we call that the contingent negative variation, and that is a very, maybe the most, the oldest psychophysiological measure ever developed. The man who developed this is called Walters, and now the first experiments using the CNV, we come to this issue later, more precise, is an index of motor preparation. So once again, the main question was, we know that the motor preparation is compromised in this group of children, but what about the cognitive steps? And the first study we were carrying out was a so-called visual attention orientation study. And no motor performance was required. So the participants, 14, 15 children with CP, and 14, 15 children without CP, had a control group. They were sitting still during this experiment in an easy chair, watching a monitor. And what they saw on the screen was this stimulus, and that was presented on the screen in 80% of the times. But now and then, this letter was replaced by the letter O. So this is a deviant stimulus. And the idea is, what is then happening in the brain? Are children aware of the fact that this stimulus changed into that stimulus? And the task duration was only a few minutes, and that was done not to confound this ability with sustained attention, maintenance of attention. And for those who are interested in this study, it's published in the Journal of Child Neurology, and you can read yourself in which year, etc., etc., etc. So here we have the stimulus. Sometimes in 20% of the cases, the O was presented. And the only thing which the children had to do was to calculate in silence the amount of O's they had seen. So, research questions, I already have said it a little bit to you. Does that deviant stimulus at the O elicit a more pronounced N2P3 complex than the standard deviation in the experimental group. And do the two groups, the CP versus the controls, differ in the discrimination of the two stimuli? And here are the result that the deviant stimuli indeed elicited a more pronounced N2P3 complex in both groups. And what is even more of interest is the finding that the controls and the group of children with CP do not differ with respect to this stimulus discrimination orientation task. And here you see the outcome. So here are the locations, and here the N2 and the P300, and there are no differences between the two groups of children. So you may ask now yourself a couple of questions. What does it mean? Whether groups are the same or are different with respect to a plus, which is now and then changing into an O. What does it tell us with respect to psychopathology? Well, I can tell you that there are many studies carried out using this types of task. And those studies, they reported differences in the N2P3 complex in, for instance, children with ADHD, in children with autism, in dyslexic children. So the fact that here, in this particular group, we didn't find differences. It doesn't mean that the task was too easy. No, we can say that the mechanism behind visual attention and orientation seems to be the same in the group of people with mild cerebral palsy. And it has to be seen, using the same task, what the results are with respect to more severe cases, or children with quadriplegia, etc., etc. Yeah. Okay, the second study. Here we were interested in all kinds of cognitive steps, the stimulus evaluation time, event preparation, so something is going to happen, and what is the preparation? Oh yeah, it will be that contingent negative variation, motor action planning. In youth, patients with mild spastic cerebral palsy. So this is a different study, and you can read, you can find it very easily in your laboratory when you are interested. This was the Journal of Child Neurology. The children were instructed to memorize the memory set of letters and to compare it with the display set. In fact, I have already discussed with you last week during the first lecture this type of task. You have to memorize one or two letters and to compare it all the time with a group of, let's say, four letters, and we call that the display set. So the children are instructed to carry out the task And the question is, does one or no letter of the memory set occur in the display set? So we have a so-called positive trial leading to a yes response. I give the example. This is the orientation. And this is the memory set, letter K. Then orientation. And here, there are four letters presented. And you can see the K is one of those four letters you were instructed to remember. So you have to give a yes response. Now, the negative trial. Orientation. For instance, the K again. It could also have been another letter, by the way. But to keep it simple. Again, orientation. And now, there are four letters. And this was the negative trial. And you can see the K is absent here. So what are the events in this study? Not the moment that the K, the stimulus, is presented. No, the moment that this group of four letters is presented, you have in mind, in this case, the letter K, and all those memory processes of encoding these four letters and making decision, that is where it is all about. This was the hand position of the participants, those 14 children. They were either diplegia or hemiplegia, so they could only use one hand. So this is the starting position. And when it is a yes response, the child was moving his hand to this position. And when it was needed to give a no response, the hand was coming to that position. So the reaction time is in fact the moment that the child has decided that he is taking away his hand from this button and he goes into this direction or that direction. And this is then the moving time, which is also of interest. And this is important for the understanding so far, that only correct responses were included as far as the reaction times are concerned. And here we see the amplitude of the event-related potential. And here we see the errors. Let's start with the reaction times. This is the reaction times of the average reaction times of the group of people with cerebral palsy. And the reaction times are slow. Logic, they have a motor problem. Here we have the reaction times of the controls. They are faster. That's logic, because they have no motor limitations. The question was, is this slowness now caused by a slowness in the cognitive steps which are taking place before the reaction time is, let's say, actually fulfilled? Therefore, we were measuring the event-related potentials. For instance, the P3 latency. And what you see is that here we have the P3 latencies expressed in latency or amplitude, and here the controls, and this was not statistically different. So when these are the cognitive steps needed to come to an offered response, then we can say that this difference in the reaction times can't be explained by slowing of the cognitive steps. So it is the motor part. Here we have the same with the errors. Those people are making more errors, the people with cerebral palsy, and that needs a different story, because here we have only plotted the correct responses. So these are correct responses, and here we have the event-related potentials. The other thing you see that is also of interest is that here we have one letter against four, and here two letters had to remember it against four. And it is logic that the reaction times are increasing simply because of the fact that you have to think more pronounced, longer. And the same holds for the P300. So it seems that on the basis of this study, we may conclude that the cognitive steps involved in this second study, encoding of the material, making decisions, is the same in people with cerebral palsy. Here we have the P300, and here we have again the P300, and these are different locations. It's the same. We were also interested in motor preparation. And here we see the memory set, the letter K, for instance. Do you remember? Then there is a time between this letter and the four letters of the display set. And because of the fact that the child had to do this task 70 times, or 100 times, I don't remember that, we were plotting the average, and you can see here the motor preparation, because the child knows, first I see a letter, and I have to compare it with four, so the motor preparation is taking place before the display set is presented. And you can see that the CNV, contingent negative variation, that it goes from positive to negative. That is why we call it negative variation. And the main finding in all the research using this CNV is the more negative it becomes, the more the person is prepared to give a response here. And you see there is it takes seconds to develop the CNV. And this is what they call in jargon the early CNV, so after a few seconds. And then we have here the late CNV, and you can see here in an open box, and this is very difficult to see, but in people with cerebral palsy, the CNV was less pronounced compared to the control group. So they have problems with motor preparation, not with the cognition. So the conclusion of this second experiment, the performance of the CP group was slower and more inaccurate compared to the controls. And the ERP analysis focused on correct responses suggests that the slowness in performance is not caused by the speed of evaluating the nature of stimuli. And maybe you now start to understand how important this finding is. Because I told you earlier that measuring the IQ is not easy in many cases with CP. because we are asking for a response, a motor response, although we are interested in the cognitive processes. And due to the slowness in performance, they will perform lower on all kinds of traditional clinical tests measuring cognition. And here, for the first time, we see that, at least in the mild cases, that they are slower, but it is not due to the motor problems. Okay, it is now 3:05. I suggest to have a break of 5-7 minutes and then to continue with a third study. Okay, see you back. So maybe it's time to continue. I hope you're all there. So in the former study, we were measuring the event-related potentials while children were carrying out a short-term memory task. They had to detect stimuli and to make decisions. We were interested in the amount of correct responses they made and also how slow they were. Were they slower than the control group? Yes. Was that slowness caused in reaction times due to compromised cognitive processes which have to be carried out in order to make such a decision, a yes or a no decision? The answer is no, that mechanism seems to be intact. And now we are arrived at the error processing, the brain state before an error occurs, during an error, and after an error. We have already discussed last week the possibility of investigating error processing in clinical population. Are they aware of the fact that they are making errors? I used as an example children with ADHD. And maybe you remember that children with ADHD were different from the controls in error processing in that sense that they were aware of the fact that they were making an error, but they didn't change their response strategy to become slower in order to avoid errors in their future research. And that is, of course, of clinical importance with respect to all kinds of interventions which could be developed on the basis of this methodology. Here we are interested in how people with cerebral palsy are acting. Are they aware of the fact that they are making errors? And are they trying to correct their performance after error making? Well, this answer is formulated also in the Journal of Child Neurology, and this study was also part of that Finnish PhD student of mine who was carrying out these experiments a couple of years ago, and she wrote a dissertation on this issue, and you can read it back. You can easily find those papers on the internet. So we start with the reaction times. And here you see a sequence, a correct response. So 1 against 4. Then the memory set is changing, the display set is changing, and again, a correct response is given. And then again, and then again, and then suddenly, there is an error. And what happens after an error? Is it so that people are aware of it? And that the next response is again a correct response? Or is it again an error? So here we have a sequence of reaction time performance. And in fact, what the participant is doing is performance monitoring. Well, this is a very important ability, that you are aware while carrying out a task whether you make an error or not, and whether you are preventing error making by means of adequate performance monitoring. So it needs effort, it needs motivation, it needs cognitive control, and it needs action monitoring. Let's start with the brain activation state before error making. So here we have the error, and we were investigating this sequence: correct response, correct response, correct response, correct response. And is the EEG in fact learning us something about the brain state before an error making? I mean, are certain amplitudes heralding the fact that on a sudden moment, an error is occurring? What you have learned now is that the amplitude of the parietal P300 potential reflects the quality of the stimulus evaluation. I have now told that to you many times. And it is the case that the P300 might drop before the error is taking place. That's for sure. The attentional resources are declining to a certain extent that an error is, in that sense, unavoidable. So the question is, we expect that the P300 amplitude is declining, but is it so that the groups are different in the decline? And is it so that, for instance, the people with cerebral palsy have a more pronounced drop in comparison to the control group with respect to the errors? here you can see a correct response, the first correct response before an error. And now we go back in the time. This is the second correct response before an error. And this is even the third correct response before an error occurs. And here we see the voltage of the P300. It goes from 35 to 1. And indeed, we see a drop. And here you see that the groups are different. But I have to say to you that this is due to a few outliers, due to a few children, because the statistical analysis learns us that this is not significant. So this could be caused by the fact that the sample was too small. If we had taken more children, maybe that this difference should have become significant, but there are all kinds of reasons not to assume that, and I will explain it to you later to you. For the moment, it seems that the P300 is heralding the fact that an error will show up, but the two groups are not different. So the cognitive evaluation decreases towards the same extent before error making in the two groups. And if you ask how much time before a real error occurs is already heralded by the P300, then we can say, well, we talk about maybe 10 seconds or even more. Yeah? So then already, with respect to the brain status, we can say an error is coming. Let's talk now about the contingent negative variation. We have already discussed this, the late part. It reflects motor preparation. This is another connotation, the readiness to respond, or the bereidschapspotentiaal. And it could also reflect the stimulus anticipation, but then again, from the motor perspective. And it is predicted that errors are preceded by a decrease of that late CNV. So the motor preparation will decline as a function of time before the error shows up. And the question is, do groups differ? Here we have 3 seconds before, three stimuli before the real error occurs. 2 events before the error occurs, and this is just before error making. And here you see again a very nice CNV. And also here, and the groups are not different, but here you see that just before error making, you see that the negativity is more pronounced in the control group, so they are preparing themselves much better before error making than the people with cerebral palsy. Look, this is much more positive than the CNV of the controls, and this is also statistically significant. So the late CNV amplitude, which is an index of motor processing, becomes less negative 1 trial before error making in the patient group, indicating more a poor motor preparation. So it is the motor part of the brain activity which is heralding error making in the clinical population, not the cognitive part, which was one slide earlier. So the people with CP, they are making more errors. We know that already. We know also that poor motor preparation is connected with this error, not the decline in DP3 amplitude. Do you remember? Now we are arrived at the issue of what happens during error making and after error making. What about those amplitudes of the brain, which are connected with the stimulus evaluation, with the ability to become aware of making errors, and what about the consequence of error awareness? Does it really lead to performance improvement on the subsequent trial? These are the findings of the group with CP children. And you see that there is a negativity. Which means that this group of children are making more errors, but they are aware of it. And here, there is hardly an error-related negativity in the control group. Well, overall, they were making less errors than the people with cerebral palsy. And here, again, I repeat myself, a more pronounced response-related negativity, so error awareness, which was then more pronounced in the people with CP, so they were very keen in trying to make the performance as correct as possible. That is what is shown by the event-related potential methodology. They are developing an ERN, error-related negativity, which was absent in the control group. And here you can see it again, that the patient group show a very much pronounced effect with respect to the response-related negativity, which was absent in the control group. So they were full aware of their error making. Yeah, you see what a huge negativity. Look, it goes from -6 to -8 to -10. So a very pronounced reaction of the brain when they were making errors. And as a result, the performance improvement after error awareness was also most pronounced in the patient group. You see it again. Here is an error. Here is the reaction after an error. And of course, it's different than in the control group, but you see in the control group, it is a stable line. So they try to do their best after making an error, they were aware of it and tried to improve their subsequent behavior. So in sum, we were talking about performance monitoring, which is a key in learning, which is a very important skill in children, in adults, and we were investigated correct responses against errors and what happens after making an error. And what we found was that in all cases, the motor preparation was involved in error making and the processes before error making, and the cognitive processes, yeah, were also intact after error making, and it's even normalized. Don't think that every scientist, that everybody agrees with respect to the indices we have discussed so far, but the majority of researchers will agree that the P300 stands for stimulus evaluation and decision making. And here I have plotting the discussion around the CNV. What is the CNV? And one key publication has been realized by Van Rijn et al. In 2011, Frontiers in Indicative Neuroscience. He's an experimental psychologist situated working in Amsterdam. And he says, well, the CNV reflects unspecific preparatory activation, anticipation, an event. And it is, of course, mediated by all kinds of circuits in the brain. What is the end conclusion? The end conclusion is that performance monitoring, a key in learning, seems intact in patients with mild spastic CP. From a clinical viewpoint, errors on cognitive tasks are associated with the motor problems involved in a disorder. So once again, the fact that people with CP can hardly fulfill the requirements of carrying out clinical tasks. Think about the IQ. They make many errors on the IQ, but it is probably not caused by their cognitive abilities or weakness of cognitive abilities. No, it is probably caused by the motor processes. So it means that in practice, the cognitive abilities using old-fashioned clinical tests in the clinic are underestimating the clinical potential, the cognitive potential in these children. We are far away of measuring event-related potentials during cognitive tests, but what we could do is to set up research in which we compare the IQ tests with these types of tests to see whether, by means of comparison, whether again the IQ processes are underestimated in clinical practice. I was a couple of years ago, oh, it was 2014, I read now, invited to be an opponent in a dissertation of a PhD student in Norway, Stadskleif et al. And she published in 2014 her final article, which was also put in her dissertation. And I was, of course, interested in that type of research, and I was very happy and also proud that I was invited to be an opponent during her dissertation and ceremony and things like that. What was so remarkable when it comes to her findings and the findings we found here in Finland with respect to the ERP studies we have discussed? What she did was the following, and you can read it in this article. There was a child or children with cerebral palsy. They were sitting on a chair and they were looking to a child without motor limitations, and that particular child was carrying out all kinds of clinical cognitive tests. So there was a whole test battery, all kinds of blocks, things I have explained to you. And that child, without motor limitations, she was instructed by the child with cerebral palsy who was sitting a little bit behind her. And the child with cerebral palsy was instructing the child which blocks to use, in which order. So, to put it in other words, the child with cerebral palsy was using verbally the hands of the child without limitations. So the child with cerebral palsy, she was telling, you have to do this first. You have to do, after you're finishing this, you have to do that. And what was the outcome? The outcome was that when the child with cerebral palsy was using, in that sense, the hands of the child without motor limitations, the performance was about the same as in the norm group. Of course, the child with CP, due to the motor limitations, she was verbally slower, maybe stuttering even. But if you take that the way it is, you accept that the way it is, and you were listening carefully to the instructions, how to do this, then the planning tasks and the inhibition tasks and things like that, they were all the same. So what we found with respect to our EEG studies comes very close to what Stutzkleif found, that CP is in the first place a motor disorder, and that the motor disorder is camouflaging, in fact, the cognitive abilities of such children. And that has, of course, negative consequences with respect to measuring IQ and things like that. Well, I think this is a good example of how to use experimental research, experimental tools for clinical purposes. But there is a little bit more, and we have still a few minutes. Nowadays, we also have, I am not involved in this type of research, but you can imagine that when here, we have a person with cerebral palsy. Here we have the eyes, here we have the brains, and here we have, let's say, the outcome of the decision making in the brains. And suppose this is measured by an outside computer, and it goes to here. To the wheel. wheelchair. So the cognitive evaluation is, I have to go to the right, I have to go to the left. Suppose the person can't speak, can't move, but he is able to think. He is able to think yes or no. Then it is a matter of tapping it, registering it, and translating it back to this machine. Here you see an operation. This is the brain, and here is the part of very complicated tools to measure the event-related potentials and things, and to give the signals, for instance, to the wheelchair. Here we have another representation. It's the same principle. Here you see the electrodes, and here you see that the signals produced by his brains are send it to the wheelchair. And here we are. I think this is a picture made in Germany. And this is, of course, part of artificial intelligence. And this is in the experimental stage. But it seems to be that it is possible. Here we have a road to go to the left, to go to the right, to avoid all objects. And I hope that also our contribution with respect to EEG characteristics might give some basis on this type of research. Now we are at the end of this lecture. It is also 15 minutes before 4. So tomorrow we will discuss, as a starter, PKU. We will discuss dopamine. And I hope that you enjoyed this lecture. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.